Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, and we come to you weekly with a critical independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Humans are top predators. We change our environment, mostly to its detriment, and we multiply and spread all over the world. We appear to be using up the Earth's resources and soiling our own nest. Although we're at the top of the food chain, tiny insects and microscopic bacteria can take us down, like right now. Some kind of balance, I guess. Still, I'd rather not get infected, and I hate seeing so many people suffer. So what's the solution? After reading our guests' two books on Lyme disease and its co-infections, I can see why so many people are sick and why the medical establishment is failing to help them. This is very complex stuff. You have to hand it to these creatures for their remarkable ability to evolve and adapt to their environment, and yes, to change their environment to survive and reproduce. Along with how we live near wild places, what chemicals and toxins we use, and most of all, the health of our innate immunity, there is much to consider. Stay tuned as we examine healing Lyme and co-infections. First, some thoughts from Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. You have an organ that is essential for your health. The cells of that organ have none of your DNA. I'm speaking, of course, about your gut microbiome, the ecosystem of over 500 species of bacteria that live in your large intestine. Your gut microbiome is essential for more than processing food. It's essential for neurological function as well as for immune function. Scientists continue to discover how the human microbiome affects disease states, including its role in arthritis, diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and even cancer. An important link between gut ecology and disease is the actual distribution of bacterial species. Imbalance in that distribution leads to ill health because those 500-odd species keep tabs on one another. This problem has received a great deal of attention in the natural health literature. Conventional medicine is catching up in its way. In natural health, the tendency is to correct microbiome imbalance through environmental change, which includes nutritional therapies. After all, what you eat creates a significant part of your microbiome's environment. In conventional medicine, a physical intervention is getting increasing attention. Formally, it's called fecal bacteriotherapy, less formally fecal transplant, and mischievously transpusion. As these names suggest, the treatment consists of transplanting a sample from a healthy microbiome into an out-of-balance microbiome through means that I'm sure it's easy for you to imagine. The theory is that balance can be restored to a person's gut by introducing the full complement of bacterial species. When first discussed, transpusion was ridiculed, as its proponents say, very much as Barry Marshall was ridiculed for proposing that the bacteria Helicobacter pylori causes ulcers. Transpusion is now on the verge of respectability with a large research literature, promotional and support organizations, and media attention. As you would expect, there are some remarkable stories. For example, a man who suffered from multiple sclerosis for 20 years, 10 of which he spent in a wheelchair, is now touring the world on his motorcycle after fecal bacteriotherapy. You might wonder why the small sample of a balanced microbiome introduced to an out-of-balanced gut ecosystem isn't simply overwhelmed. I'm sure that in some cases it is, but just as introducing micronutrients missing from your diet can have dramatic health effects, introducing missing microspecies of bacteria can have the same kind of effect. Unfortunately, those microspecies can't be cultured outside the gut. I have two thoughts. One concerns the promotion of probiotics, particularly in the natural health literature. Although use of probiotics has been shown to improve health in some cases, probiotics consist of only a few of the dominant microbiome species. Missing are the microspecies that are the equivalent of micronutrients. My other thought is that a new procedure, however effective, does not solve the environmental trauma that caused the microbiome imbalance in the first place. In some cases, the rebalance might stick because the original environmental trauma doesn't recur. But in most cases, the environment is still there, ready to do its damage. I'm sure you're painfully aware of the horrors created by industrial agriculture, for example, the torment of animals in so-called confined animal feeding operations. I'm also sure that you're aware of the risks posed by GMO crops. In a recent Counterpunch article, Catherine Paul of the Organic Consumers Association argues that feeding animals GMO feed in confined animal feeding operations amounts to torture all on its own. GMO crops are bred to survive treatment with pesticides and herbicides, supposedly to increase crop yields. Glyphosate is the most widely used GMO herbicide, and Roundup is the most widely used glyphosate product. Turns out that glyphosate chews up micronutrients such as manganese and cobalt, causing, for example, developmental problems in young animals, problems that I won't recount here so that I don't put those images in your head. In addition to developmental problems, glyphosate exposures disrupt the gut microbiome of livestock. Again, I will not put any images in your head, but take my word that the effects are awful. I had this thought, as I'm sure you did too. If GMO crops have devastating effects on a cow's or a calf's microbiome and consequently on their health, what effect is it having on your or your child's microbiome and health? This is a thought shared by many. I also had this thought. Will fecal bacteriotherapy save us from that microbiome havoc? A transcript of this comment is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett's a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is the primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic, which is healing Lyme disease and co-infections, and today's guest, who is Stephen Harrod Booner, and his first name is the Stephen. Harrod is Harrod, and Booner is Buhner. He lectures throughout the United States on herbal medicine, the sacredness of plants, and the intelligence of nature. Some of his other books include Healing Lyme, his newest book, Healing Lyme Co-Infections, and The Secret Teachings of Plants. He lives in Silver City, New Mexico, and we're very grateful that you could take the time to be with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. These books are quite remarkable. I have some knowledge or understanding of this topic, but nowhere near the in-depth that you go into here. You've done a real service to the medical community and to people who are suffering from these syndromes.
Thank you.
Now, we're seeing, I would say, really epidemic numbers of infections of Lyme, and now what you call the co-infections, which are introduced at the same time as the Lyme spirochete, through vectors that carry Lyme, that are blood feeding vectors. The New York Times yesterday had a whole section on Lyme, and not surprisingly, the little essays were really stupid. I mean, it was really disappointing how
the New York Times, I mean, they think of themselves as the paper of record, but and all the news that's fit to print, and really they're one of the best newspapers in the country, and they're still, it's the lack of depth is phenomenal.
Yeah, it was very safe, what they said. Even Amy Tan talking about her own, that was the most compelling, was her talking about how seriously it's affected.
Well, she's a great writer, yeah. And the people that get Lyme, it's quite devastating for some of them, so the combination would make for a compelling story, but that's rarely, the newspapers or the commercial news outlets really go much further than that kind of a story.
Some people feel very strongly that there are politics to what's going on, that this epidemic is that something's going on here. Either that, I think there are theories that this may have been some kind of as often is the case with epidemics, some kind of material that was introduced as warfare. People wonder what's going on, what the government is doing about this. So part of the suffering that people with these syndromes have is that, again, they're not taken seriously at all. And it mimics so many other chronic diseases. So what's going on politically here? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I do. And I've been speaking and teaching about plants and medicine and healing for over 30 years. And one of the most common questions that began showing up about 18 years ago, I guess, was about Lyme disease, and at a lot of people's urging, I finally started really looking into it. So you have to understand, I've read every journal article that has been published that I could find, and every book that's been published that I could find, and the journal articles themselves present a very different picture than the picture that we get from newspapers or from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta or even from conventional technological physicians. And so, of course, I mean, there's a lot of people that began to think, oh, maybe Plum Island introduced it because it sort of started in that area. But I actually think that the explanation is, in a sense, more mundane and also more frightening when you really start to get into the depths of it. And they've traced, you know, from doing analysis of bodies that have been exhumed or mummies that are many thousands of years old, that they found Lyme and many of these co-infectious bacteria in their bodies. So the disease organisms are extremely ancient. The genetic analysis of them shows that they split off from their ancestors, let's say, 600 million years ago. So they've been around for a long time, only people didn't really have a way to test for them. So we would have heart disease, or we'd have some sort of brain dementia, or arthritis, and the symptoms would be diagnosed, but not necessarily the root organism that was part of the initiating factor for the disease emergence. And the thing is, what's really fascinating is looking at what most physicians think about it, and most news articles say, and what the CDC says, it has absolutely no relation at all to what the researchers in the journal papers are saying. And I think a lot of the reason is because of the nature of these organisms and sort of the nature of the time that we're in. The many bacterial researchers are describing these organisms as second-generation pathogens. And what they mean by that is that we dealt with the easy ones, so to speak, the ones where a simple antibiotic treatment could alter the course of the disease. They consider those first generation, like, strep or things like that, or staph infections, things sort of like that. And these kind of organisms are more properly considered, they're kind of a stealth pathogen. They have very unique ways of getting in the body and of hiding from the immune system, hiding from diagnostic techniques, and they're very hard to eradicate once they get in place. And the CDC, for instance, will say, oh, there's like 20,000 new Bartonella infections, or there's 40,000 new Lyme infections. But researchers at Harvard and other places consistently say that's anywhere from 10 to 100 to 1,000 times inaccurate, depending upon which organism they're looking at. And what seems to be true when you really get deep into it is that it's really our increasing population numbers combined with ecosystem disruption at much greater levels than we've ever seen before, and people then moving into those disrupted bioregions. And what happens is most of these organisms lived in other mammal species, and now most of those mammal species are decreasing in numbers, are being relegated to more peripheral roles, and the basic big mammal species left is us. So they're jumping quite readily into our bodies. And it's really the thing is, population problems have a horrible way of solving themselves. And when you get this kind of ecological disruption, then we start to pay the price. And these bacteria are extremely intelligent, extremely adaptable, and we're just running up against, actually, in a lot of ways, a species much smarter than we are.
Well, certainly the bacteria are, and interestingly also the ticks, although as you say, there are mosquitoes carrying this, and you can pick things up also by being close to other people with Lyme, which is a concept that was brought up on a show I did many years ago by David Bierman, who has written extensively on this, and who said, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, said it's infectious, you know, it's contagious in families, it's carried in urine and saliva and things. So the Lyme ticks themselves are quite extraordinary. I mean, I've recently had some experience with them, and sometimes I'll walk through an area and wearing very light clothing and covered up, and I'll just kind of walk through and say, okay, girls, take your best shot, you know. And I'm brushing them off as I go, but they dive into your skin very fast. They really get in there fast. They're very effective, and they're very. I mean, there's a children's show I love called The Wildcrats. I'm going to try to interview the brothers, but they do a lot of shows where they tell children about creature powers and how extraordinary they are. And I think, well, as much as they gross me out, ticks have amazing creature powers, and that's part of the irony of this is that we think we're so smart. So, you know, here we are with climate change and all the rest, and we're losing, as you said, the top predators that keep control over the mammals that these ticks are riding on. But the other problem is that the environment itself has changed. So what sorts of environments are better for control? I mean, I know that among other things there are species of reptiles and lizards that carry the Lyme ticks on their cheeks and neutralize the Lyme. So there are other species like that that are protective, that help balance this. You want to explain who those might be?
Well, it's the dynamic that I look at is that most people don't realize that the environment in which we're embedded is actually a living system. I mean, it's sort of popular to talk that way, but we most of us tend to look at as ourselves the primary actors moving across a backdrop of a static stage to which we can do anything we wish. And the understanding that we're emerging in the midst of a scenario that's highly intelligent and that is at least 3.5 billion years old and is highly adaptable to slight alterations in anything that occurs. Any sort of pebble dropped into that pond creates ripples, and the entire system begins to immediately respond to it by shifting around. So the thing about most parasitic organisms, which this group of organisms called Lyme and its co-infections, they're parasites, and they generally can't live in the wild. They have to live inside of a host, and they normally don't kill their host because, you know, the more beneficent they are to the host, the more they're able to extract nutrients from the host body, and everybody's then really happy. The problem becomes when they begin to move from one host to another. So many of the organisms that have Lyme spirochetes in them don't experience the kind of negative dynamics we do, and I have a caveat on that. One of the things that happened, some people did some really great analysis of viruses and organisms like Lyme and its co-infections, and they found that those organisms act very much like, let's say, a pride of lions. And what they do is when they move through a particular species, most of the species is left unaffected. They, they live in balance with them. But the interesting thing is all of the research has shown with every one of these groups of bacteria that if the immune function begins to drop, then the disease begins to blossom. And the worse the immune function, the more severe the disease and the more severe the symptoms.
Yeah, and that is part of the sort of good news along with the bad news. Let me just tell people you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. We are interviewing Stephen Harrod, H-A-R-R-O-D, Booner, B-U-H-N-E-R, and Stephen is the long spelling. His newest book is Healing Lyme Disease Co-Infections, and he's discussing here Bartonella and Mycoplasma bacteria. Now, what you say over and over and over again in the book, and it's what I've been saying about this disease, as well, these confluence of diseases, is that your immune system is the key, and the key to avoiding these kinds of really serious chronic illnesses is to mind your immune system very carefully. And then, and the part of this that's inconvenient is that this includes resting when you're tired.
Yeah, but that's inconvenient in America.
Yeah,
true.
Right.
In Europe, it's much more common.
Right. So tell us, do that dance a bit. Talk about, because one of the things that happens with all of these particularly intelligent and adaptable spirochete-type bacterial infections and the mycoplasmas, which are microscopic, and the Bartonella, all of them, is that they adapt very fast and very efficiently to everything that goes on. So if you blast them with various things, they adapt to that. The one thing they can't stop, the one thing that sends them, you know, makes them put their socks on and pack their bags, is if your innate immune system, your complement system, is working. So please explain that.
Well, basically, our immune system is, even though the human species is, if you really extend it as far as you can, is about 2 million years old. Our particular current form is about 35,000 years old. But the immune system that we have is very, very, very ancient, and it's based on patterns that have been in development for millions, hundreds of millions of years. So it has the ability to deal with a lot of these external events, and that's what it's designed to do, to help our system integrity remain coherent. And one of the reasons that these microbes are called stealth pathogens is because they use a number of mechanisms to hide from the immune system of whatever animal or organism that they get into. And one of the ways they do that is they change their gene structure. They literally, microbes actually initiate genetic changes in their DNA structure, in the genomic structure, to create different variants of themselves, so that if the immune system analyzes one and begins to kill it, there's many others in the body that it can't find. The thing is, the healthier the immune system, the more rapidly it can identify them, and also it tends to repair any damage that they cause extremely rapidly. So for a lot of people, like for instance in the United States, there's anywhere from 50 to 270 million people asymptomatically infected with mycoplasma, depending upon how you had the figures up or the studies. And there's about 35 million people asymptomatically infected with Bartonella. They don't have any symptoms. There's a really nice balance because their body is fairly healthy and their immune system is really strong. It's only what happens if you start to get older, which is immune senescence. Our immune system gets old just like we do. It's not as effective then, and are if you've been overworking, burning the candle at both ends, not taking good care of yourself, or for some reason your immune system begins to drop, then they become opportunistic and they begin to bloom, and you start to get a whole series of symptoms or disease that begins to occur. So one of the major ways to deal with it is to keep your immune system really healthy. And for a lot of people, that once they can sort of deal with, who have been ill, once they can deal with the initial sort of disease dynamics and reduce those and bring their immune system up, then their quality of life is restored again, and they're fine.
Now, what's fascinating is your description of how your immune system is altered right away when a tick creates a little canal for the blood to come through and all of that. I mean, you have to have an effective immune system partially because even before these little infectious bacteria get in and these little wormy spirochetes, you've got the tick trying to alter your immune system to accept what's going on. So,
well, blood feeders like that, they have a really ancient way of doing that. I mean, when they bite you, they don't want you to notice it a lot of the time, mm-hmm. like a tick does, and so they actually inject a sort of a Novocaine substance in to kill the nerve endings, and then they inject another substance which keeps the blood from coagulating so that they continue to feed, and they inject other substances which stop, you know, the white blood cells and your different immune dynamics from attacking the point of attachment. And so because they carry in their body many of these other organisms, those other organisms work synergistically with them. They take advantage of that, and they go from the saliva or the salivary glands of the tick into the bloodstream, in which they then find different parts of different, basically, parts of the bloodstream, and they hide within those cells and get taken to the parts of the body that they're most happy living in. And so it's a very ancient co-evolutionary synergistic relationship that they have. And all of us are continually dealing with, all living organisms are continually dealing with events like this. It's just, you know, the healthier we are, the more in balance we can remain with it. So whether we have Lyme or Mycoplasma or Bartonella is irrelevant if we're fairly healthy.
So this is part of what makes it very tricky to know if you notice that you got bitten, whether or not you need to get tested, because you may or may not get a rash. You may or may not feel sick.
Is present in only about, I believe, 50%, 60% of the cases, so it's not a good indicator in terms of definitive diagnosis, no.
And some people don't actually get ill either.
They get a mild case of the flu, and then they're fine, and that's it. You know, and actually, you know, you're broadcasting from Berkeley, and that whole Northern California area is really one of the major, there's kind of three major hotspots in the country there, kind of the Wisconsin-Minneapolis area and the East Coast, mostly in the Northeast, but really in Virginia it's fairly bad now, too, from Virginia up. So, mm-hmm. you know, I understand there's a lot of concern for people because you can actually, there's not an easy way to tell if that's the disease that you have. It mimics so many others.
It does.
And the diagnostics from conventional medicine just aren't very good.
No, they're really not. They're very confusing and not very good. And I have heard from some people who have experience with this that, oh, and incidentally, we actually are independent, so we're broadcasting from West Sonoma County, which is a real ticky area. And we're about to move from one forested area to another, and we're moving to a river bottom, so we're moving right to it. I'm getting kind of familiar with the ticks and what to do. And, of course, your work is extraordinarily helpful. Again, we're talking to author of Healing Lyme and Healing Lyme Disease Co-Infection, Stephen Howard Harrod Booner.
Well, it's pronounced just like Herod, like the bad
Herod.
Thing in the Bible. But,
right.
you know, I'm not him.
You're not him. Harrod, and Booner is Buhner. We're going to break momentarily, but, you know, some people say 24 to 36 hours after you've been bitten, if you feel flu-ish, go get tested. Do you agree?
Well, the problem is that the tests aren't very accurate. So, yeah, you can do that, and if you're lucky enough to have a Lyme-literate physician who really knows how to read the tests and is using the Western blot instead of ELISA, yeah, then they could possibly tell. But even then, the tests are not diagnostically definitive. There's a lot of false negatives because they're just not that sensitive.
Plus, one of the things that you do in the book that's wonderful is that you have some markers like for unresolved disease, for instance, the low CD57. And you also mentioned that in the Western blot test, you can look for specific lines to be positive.
And,
so you give people some help with that. We're going to take a brief musical break. Again, we're talking to Stephen Howard. I have so much trouble saying that word.
I could never say sphincter. I tightened up every time I got near it.
Harrod Buhner, B-U-H-N-E-R, author of many books on Lyme disease and plant medicine. We're going to break just briefly. I'd love it if you would stay with us. We have a lot more to discuss. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our over 500, probably more like 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a live stream of this week's show, our book, and a lot more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. If you want to reach us, please do it by email, admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Stephen, you don't like getting bombarded, which you do. You prefer people to do what? Go to your website?
Yeah, I get probably 200 to 300 emails a month, and we probably get 5 to 10 calls a day, and based on the telephone, and there's no way that I can keep up with it anyway. But the best way for people to contact me if they need to is to go to our website and then email, which is GaianStudies.org, GaianStudies.org.
Okay, and we'll put that on our website as well, yourownhealthandfitness.org. I am acutely aware of the fact that we're not going to get through all the material we need to talk about, so I'm wondering whether you will be willing to come back for a second show so people can anticipate that if you are.
Sure.
Okay, so we'll do a second show because we're not going to get through all of this, and there's so much stuff here to talk about. Okay, testing is problematic. The other problem is that physicians, one of the ironic things here is that both Western and alternative physicians tend to either over or underestimate the importance of this disease. The conventional docs don't take it seriously. The naturopaths and the rest of the more alternative people take it too seriously, and everybody gets a blanket diagnosis of Lyme for everything. And the thing is, it's like everything in the sense that if your immune system is in poor shape and you're exhausted, any number of things which have been like dormant in your system will come popping up and give you a chronic illness. I mean, it's also possible for other imbalances to be happening in the endocrine system, the thyroid, all sorts of other things. And I'm seeing also increasingly that people who are being exposed to this proliferation of wireless microwave technologies are reaching a point where there's such an exponential explosion that the fields are making people very, very ill. And they are, in fact, attacking our immune systems. I mean, one of the effects that we know from studying science that's being done all over Europe and Sweden is that, you know, it causes heat shock proteins, it causes the immune system to go into hyper overdrive, and it's a drag on the immune system. We're seeing a lot of new diagnoses of very complex autoimmune diseases. So how do you sort through this other than to know that if you're in a tick-infested area and you suddenly become very ill, it might be wise to begin to think?
Well, it's usually the ones where it tends to be more difficult to figure out is if there's neurological problems. And if it's arthritis, Lyme-caused arthritis, it's a little bit easier to figure out because whatever you do to protect that part of the body is going to help reduce the Lyme influx anyway. But all of these co-infections, one of the things that they have in common, and it's particularly strong in the United States, is that they tend to be getting into the brain and into the central nervous system, and they cause a variety of neurological problems, which are much harder to diagnose. So it calls for a tremendous sophistication, and I think part of what's really happening, and I talk about this in depth in the beginning of the co-infection book and also in my book on herbal antibiotics, that we're at a time when the old paradigm of medicine that we've been immersed in for about a century now, that started coming into the fore after the Civil War in the 1880s or so, we've really reached the end of the functionality of that paradigm. And the health system in the United States is extremely dysfunctional. With Lyme, one of the things that we found early on is that you really have to spend about an hour with any person who has Lyme or co-infection to work with them. You can't spend 7 to 15 minutes. Healing is really much more of an art form than the technological people really let on. And the ones who really know what they're doing, they really do understand that. You can't reduce it to a simple ABC. So you have to, after a while, start to get kind of a feel for how these diseases present themselves and how they begin to work in the body. And part of what I've been encouraging for a long time and trying with my books and everything, teaching and everything else, is to get the system to begin to shift itself toward actually dealing with the people that are ill. And a lot of that's having to happen outside the structures currently in place, because most people that go to physicians, there's always a few people that have great experiences, but most people just don't, because the doctor never really looks at them and their disease complex. One of the primary things I've heard over and over and over again, and as I've heard it, you know, several thousand times, people go to a physician and they say, I think I have Lyme, or I think I have Bartonella. And the doctor goes, well, do you live in a Lyme endemic area, or do you have a cat? And they go, no. And they go, well, then you don't have it. Not only that they just say that you won't have it, they won't even test for it. They won't even look for it. So being able to get to it and sort of parse through things to find out what's really underneath and begin to treat it effectively, it takes a real sensitivity of perception, a real willingness to be present with the people that come to you for healing, and a real desire to really to understand what's going on and really heal, to do your job as a healer rather than to give people 7 to 15 minutes, charge the insurance company, and give them some antibiotics and scoot them out the door. That's just not going to work with these things. So, you know, in the neurological stuff, after a while, once you've had a lot of exposure, you can start to see that spectrum of dynamics, whether and figure out whether it's an actual dementia or whether it's a Bartonella cause dynamic. And you can start to use interventions. Plants can be very sophisticated in reducing the inflammations that occur in the nerve systems in the brain. It can begin to regenerate damaged nerve sheaths and nerve fibers and the whole nervous system. So we've seen reductions in neurological symptoms really within a matter of a few days, and it can really be done. It's just we're really needing to have a new paradigm come into play that's more sophisticated.
So I noticed that you said if you have a cat, you didn't say if you have a dog. So since I am a cat owner, what were you thinking?
Well, the reason I said that is Bartonella, there were kind of a couple of kinds of Bartonella, which are the only two sort of ones that doctors in North America know about. One's kind of called trench fever, and it was it's commonly spread from lice, and it was called that because in World War I, in the trenches, there were a lot of lice, and homeless people tend to get that kind a lot. And it's also spread by head lice and pubic lice, so it's not just the homeless people that get that. So then the thing is, and the other kind was called cat scratch fever, that the fleas that are on cats are infected with Bartonella. They poop. The cat cleans itself, and so if a cat scratches you, that the minute remnants of the flea feces can get in your skin, and then the bacteria go into your body. So that's the primary kind that physicians know about, and they think if you don't have a cat, then you can't get it. And that's, I mean, it's really egregious malpractice.
Yes, I'll say. Isn't it
just? Because dogs, about 30% of dogs have it. About half of all veterinarians are infected with Bartonella just because of their exposure to animals. Virtually every companion animal and domestic farm animal that humans come into contact with have either Mycoplasma or Bartonella or both. So these are very common organisms. They're not species specific, they're species preference. So they like living in cats, but the interesting thing is, for instance, in cats and dogs, there's human preference species that tend to live in those animals and then jump into us. The companion animals are actually used as a mechanism of transmission. So, you know, for instance, like with the Bartonella, a lot of physicians think there's only two or three kinds. Well, there's actually, you know, 17 or 18 different types that have been identified that can infect human beings. And Mycoplasma, there's about 30 now that infect human beings, but most physicians only know of Mycoplasma pneumoniae, which is tends to infect the lungs. So it's we're dealing with a just because these guys went to school doesn't mean they know anything.
Do you think? I've noticed that. Haven't? So the other thing is that Jeffrey always says, don't think the MD stands for minor deity.
I grew up in a family of physicians, including a Surgeon General of the United States, a president of the Kentucky Medical Association. My great-grandfather was primarily a botanic physician who had the most influence for me. So things have changed a lot in the years since my great-grandfather practiced. And he went to people's homes, and he really focused on the people. And it's not the same world anymore. The truth is, these are not very bright guys often, and things have just kind of got out of hand.
Well, they're getting overcompensated for the work they do.
Yeah, they are.
So if you just have a regular job, then you would go in because you wanted to help people, not because you wanted to have many
houses.
Right, and
that's one of the big problems.
Oh, sure,
really is.
Sure. So, a reminder, your own health and fitness here, and we're talking to Stephen Harrod Buner.
That's right. Excellent.
H-N-E-R. I know. It just takes practice.
It does.
Buner is B-U-H-N-E-R, and it's Healing Lyme Disease Co-Infections, which is the new book. And just in case you haven't gotten this through the conversation we're having, the co-infections, Bartonella and Mycoplasma, and there's another one mentioned in the New York Times article, are transmitted by the same vectors that transmit Lyme disease. And so you'll get it from a tick bite, you'll get it from mosquito bite or chiggers or some other little blood suckers.
Pretty much any kind of biting insect.
Blood suckers.
Most of those. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and his website and email will be on our website at yourownhealthyfitness.org. Now, if we can shift to prevention, now the main prevention, again and over again, is to care for your immune system. And we mentioned rest when you're tired, which it really is no joke. And now every time I get tired, I think to myself, you want a case of Lyme?
Right. Well, there's nothing, you know, there's this great old saying, there's nothing like a good chronic disease to get you to increase your awareness about taking care of yourself.
Well, it's nice to do it before so you don't get it.
Well,
it is,
but we're people, and so therefore.
Yeah, well, people also have brains. We also do have the ability to process information.
Yeah.
And potentially we have the ability to learn, supposedly.
Yeah, potentially.
We have that. So let's talk about some of the other things that people can do to help their immune system. You mentioned various botanicals. Astragalus is one of them.
Right, well, people that live in an endemic Lyme area, the best thing that they can do is take astragalus every day. I mean, in China, they cook with it. They make, you know, astragalus infusions. They make the rice from it. They make astragalus soups. And they just use it as sort of a water stock and a tea infusion stock for cooking. But if you take 1,000 milligrams a day of astragalus, and during the Lyme season when it really gets going, 3,000 milligrams a day, that actually will raise all of the immune markers that are necessary to interfere with Lyme getting a toehold in your body. And also, if it does, then the disease progression and symptoms tend to be extremely mild. There's been some really good studies on that. They're really nicely done, and it's just clear in study after study after study. So it's really one of the easiest things you can do. I like astragalus, I like rhodiola, I like Eleutherococcus entocosis, it's used to be called Siberian ginseng, and cordyceps are probably the four that I tend to take most often, and just to keep my immune system up. I'm 61, so my immune system's getting old. I get sick easier. It's harder for me to get well. It takes longer, so that keeps things in a lot better shape than otherwise. But if that's one of the easiest things.
So Stephen, I have a question.
Yeah.
Why do you prefer the powdered herbs to the tinctures?
Okay, in terms of prevention, it doesn't matter what form.
Good, because I like tinctures.
As long as they're good quality stuff. In terms of treating Lyme, one of the major emphases I put in the book, like probably the best herb to treat Lyme, is Japanese knotweed root. And most people don't realize that when you're making a tincture or an infusion with water, that you're creating an extractive dynamic that pulls the active constituents out of the herb. Well, the oldest extractive medium is really our stomach acids and our bile and pancreatic acids. So when you take the whole herb, your body extracts actually what it needs. And for Lyme, I'm not as much on this with the co-infections, but with Lyme, that what I found is that if people take the powdered root itself, then the body pulls out of it whatever it needs. And it actually, I've seen much better effects with that. Some people can't take the powders, so they do the tinctures instead, and those will work. But that's the primary reason why, because the body's very ancient, very wise, very aware, and you take whatever it wants out of there and just, you know, it excretes the rest.
Yeah, the other thing is that for some people, some of these herbs are irritating to the gut. You know, the cordyceps can be irritating to the gut. Do you have any instructions for helping people with that? I mean,
lot of this stuff in terms of dosage levels, what herbs you take and everything else, it's really important that people pay close attention to how they respond to things. I mean, people will be much more, they'll tend to pay much more attention to how herbs affect them than, for instance, pharmaceuticals. Probably,
yes.
You know, 80% of the people we see, they'll have this whole list of symptoms, and the very first thing that we'll do is we'll correlate all of the pharmaceuticals, the side effects from the pharmaceuticals with their symptoms. Easily 90% of their symptoms will turn out
absolutely
to be from the pharmaceuticals,
absolutely,
not the disease.
Yep.
So people just have to be really, really aware of that. There's some people that will take, you know, two drops of a lomatium tincture and feel horribly ill from it, and other people that can take a teaspoon at a time. So there's a lot of individual variation.
Sure is.
People just need to be clear, as well as dosages. I've seen people, you know, a 6'4", 250-pound guy take three drops of something, and that's all he needs, and,
right,
you know, a 5-foot, 1-inch woman, 92 pounds, who has to take tablespoonfuls. It's there's a huge wide range.
Yeah, there's an individual dose response.
Yeah, and you know, that kind of awareness is important. But as, you know, and then you can begin to moderate it. There's some things, you know, I need to take CalMag every so often, and I don't like it because my body doesn't like it. Nevertheless, it's good for me. So I find ways to take it that it just won't disrupt.
You can soak in Epsom salts.
You know, I've tried that, and all I get is it just feels like I'm on a grainy beach. You know, it's like the stuff grinds into my ass.
Okay. Well, you probably have to mix it up in some water ahead of time and then add it to. So we're getting close to the end of the interview, and there's some things I want to ask you about. Now, a lot of people, I've heard people say this all the time, like especially in Mendocino County, that they always keep on hand either, you know, doxycycline or some similar full-spectrum antibiotic. And if they get bitten and they don't feel well afterwards, they immediately take a series of it. There, I think, after reading your books, is something wrong with that.
Well, the thing is, these diseases can cause such serious problems. I mean, really, literally bedridden, mentally not functional. That, you know, I support the use of antibiotics. Most of the people that we see, they've used antibiotics and they haven't worked. But if some people are going to be doing that, literally the best antibiotic for Lyme is doxycycline.
Yeah, yeah. It's
you
also
know, you get probably about 60% of the people that take it will be permanently cured by using it. The initial figures are about 95%, but there's about a 30-35% relapse rate. So it's probably one.
So it's worth a shot. It's worth a shot to keep it. And the other thing that's nice about doxy is that it is, of all the antibiotics, it's a fairly well tolerated one. And antibiotics are bitter and cool too, so they work in a number of different ways.
Right.
The other thing about doxy is, well, there's in your book you say if you're going to do it 7 to 10 days, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Because with other types of infections, I note that you can get over something in about 3 days, talking to pharmacists who know about this, but I get it that the Lyme...
Lyme is really quite often 14 to 30 days if you've got a recalcitrant one, and that'll often, if the antibiotics are going to work, then they will work after 30 days. For instance, Bartonella tends to cause hypertrophy of the endothelial lining of the blood vessels because it lives in the endothelial lining. It increases the production of that to create more habitat, and then about every 10 days or so, it goes into the bloodstream and infects the red blood cells. So one of the great antibiotics for it is erythromycin because it normalizes endothelial tissue.
Got it.
And so physicians should really know about that, and people should know about that. Really, all of these co-infections in Lyme, they can be treated naturally, and, you know, we've just seen great success over the last 10 years. It's you can get well. You don't have to remain sick. You really don't.
So one last thing about doxy or any antibiotic you take, remember that these drugs will kick your vitamin B out totally and will affect rather seriously your nutrient density. So make sure that you're taking a B-complex and a multivitamin and taking your vitamin C a couple times a day.
And that's also especially true with mycoplasma, which one of
yes,
its
indeed.
Primary side effects
yes.
is nutrient depletion
yes.
in the body. So.
Yes, and all the amino acid stuff. That's why I want to have you on again, is that I want to dig deeper into this. All right, let's talk about environmental issues. Okay, spritz yourself with any plant essential oil just to make them nauseous, or, you know, there's all this stuff about cedar, spraying it around your house. I don't think you want to put it on your cat because it'll make your cat vomit. They don't have the right enzymes to deal with essential oils. But is it ever appropriate to spritz yourself with essential oils as well as covering up when you're hiking?
I actually, you know, have created my own form of, you know, anti-insect spray that works extremely well for that. And, you know, rosemary, rose geranium, cedar, juniper oil, juniper berry oil, those particular ones are extremely good at keeping most insects away. So I just add a teaspoon of each of those essential oils, and then I add twice the amount of that liquid.
Water?
No, not twice the amount. I add that to 4 ounces of pure grain alcohol, and then I just spritz with that. It works really well.
Oh, okay, different. And I guess you could spritz the back of your cat's neck or the back of your dog's neck where they can't lick it. Then there's the issue of, like, your yard. I've heard from that planting lavender plants all over the place, having chickens.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, chickens do like to eat ticks, and so, I mean, they are descendant of dinosaurs, so, I mean,
right.
they actually are predators.
Yeah,
and,
they are. They eat a lot of protein.
Yeah, and they do. And so, and lavender does help keep down a lot of different things. But mostly what's really happening is we're being reminded that we live in the midst of a living world and that there's not really any way to really escape from that. So we have to somehow learn how to live in harmony.
Absolutely.
With it, and we have to find a way to go into the wild and not be terrified by it.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to give people some. So, and then again, I've heard that they don't care about cold water. So if I go into my favorite little spot in the river where I like to swim, am I likely to pick up a tick there?
I've never seen a tick swimming in cold water.
Good, I like it. And then is it, my worst, this is a personal question, my worst fear is I'm going to move my favorite new cat to this property, and he's going to come bounding in the morning and get on my bed with, you know, critters on him. So do I put a white sheet on the bed so that I can see them? Do I not let him in to do that before I get to flea comb him?
You got into an area where I have absolutely no idea.
You haven't found a good solution yourself,
well,
huh?
No, I live in South.
You live in the, oh, you moved to the place where they don't have
it. Mexico.
Right.
We have no insects here except for, you know, the local bankers and politicians.
Right,
that,
right. Right, and you just have, you know, like lots of forest fires and no water at this point. But
actually, we have, it seems like that, but we actually are in a heavy, we have a lot of water here.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll see how this goes. Maybe I'll make another move, although I'm moving to a place that I adore more than anything, so I think I'm willing to put up with the downsides, of which there are many in any
it
place you
beautiful
go.
Beautiful there.
Yeah, well, this is yeah, where we're going is really exceptional. All right, so... people should reach you again by doing what?
Well, they can look at my website, guyanstudies.org, and they can also, there's a somebody who is really interested in my work, and they created a website called Buhner Healing Lyme, B-U-H-N-E-R, healinglyme.com, and a lot of information about Lyme and co-infections can be found at that site.
And if they must... Well, they should, have, of course, get your books, which...
Well, the books will explain how the diseases work and how they can treat them and take care of them. And there's also lists of practitioners in most of the books and on the website, so that can help them as well.
So it's Healing Lyme is your earlier book, which is still, it seems like you just wrote it. It's right up to date as far as I can tell. And then Healing Lyme Disease Co-Infections. I do want to talk to you again about the mycoplasma stuff, because that's the bulk of the book and very, very, very interesting stuff. The thing that's tricky, we actually talked to Garth Nicholson, I don't know, 8 years ago about mycoplasma infections, because it was his theory that this was the root of most of this chronic illness. You know, all of the Cephas cases and stuff were actually undiagnosed
right.
Mycoplasma. And especially after looking at, you should see on my little sticky notes, it's pretty clear that that's true. Is there something, I have a couple minutes, you know, like a minute and a half. Do you have something brief you want to say about that?
Well, mycoplasma, it can literally affect any part of the body and cause a huge variety of symptoms. And it's a lot more difficult of a problem than most people understand. It is easily treatable, but the problem is that you just have to know that that's what it is before you can do so. But I found it a fascinating disease and incredibly challenging to write about, which is why the book was so thick. My publisher screamed when it came into their office.
Well, the good news here is that people live in areas that are pandemic in these things and don't get sick, and that has to do with taking care of yourself, which is what this show is about. So, Stephen Harrod Buhner, B-U-H-N-E-R, I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
We'll do it again soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for extended access to our very many archive shows with our library card. You can listen to the show again there, our book, lots more, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Reach us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.